We're glad you're here on this misty morning for chapel, and it's always a special day when we have a lecture series like we did last week, when there's someone who is a real authority in a particular field who can come and share with us and allow us to have a greater understanding of God's Word and its application in our lives and ministries. And yet, we also have some of our own home folks right here at our own faculty who are real experts in their field, who come to share a faculty lecture one per semester. And we're very delighted that today's faculty lecture will be given by Dr. Keith Idle, who certainly fits into that category as an expert in his field. And coming to introduce him now is Dr. Gerald Cohen, who is dean of our college.
Before I introduce Dr. Idle to you, let me first ask, is Mrs. Idle here yet? I didn't see her. There she is. Would you stand up, and Angela? And they all... They also have a son named Paul who's at the Citadel. Now, I want to say, Dr. Idle, I've been friends a long time, and I could say a lot of things, probably some of them he wish I wouldn't say. But there are three things I want to say about Dr. Idle very quickly. You can read a lot of the things in the bulletin, so I don't need to go over all that. But first of all, he's a man with a lot of education. He's got a BA from Dallas Baptist, an MA in church history from Baylor University, a doctor of missiology from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He has postdoctoral study at the University of North Texas. And he's now about to finish a second doctorate in historical missiology at the University of South Africa. He's also a man of experience. He has experience as an associate pastor, a pastor. He at Criswell College was not only a professor, but dean of undergraduate studies and dean of students. He served 4 years as academic dean at the Cameroon Baptist Theological Seminary in Cameroon, West Africa. So he has a lot of academic and mission experience. But most of all, I want to say to you that Dr. Idle is a man with the world on his heart. He's a man who wants to see the gospel taken to the whole world, that every person might have opportunity to know Jesus. Dr. Idle, we look forward to hearing what God has to say through you this morning. Come and bring our lecture.
Well, my book's too big or the podium's too little. I don't know which it is. It's going to fall off here. Well, thank you for all those words. Don't believe half of them. I feel, like an expert this morning. You know what an expert's definition is? It's a former drip under pressure. So that's what I feel like this morning. I feel a little awkward doing this lecture. I much prefer preaching. But I have mixed emotions. On the one hand, I'm really excited about the things that I've been researching for the last 3 years and want to share those with you. But yet, on the other hand, I also feel a little in fear and intimidation because I know how little most of you like to have a lecture read to you. And yet, this is the format that seems to be apropos in certain erudite academic settings. So if you understand that I'm approaching this with a little bit of caution and qualification in that regard. Just bear with me. I'll try to read it with zest and gusto so that hopefully we can all benefit from it. Let me just share with you from the outset what has prompted my thinking in the last 3 years along these lines. Some years back, I was invited by Dr. Timothy George and Dr. David Dockery to contribute a section to their edited volume entitled Baptist Theologians. I did the section, the chapter on James Madison Pendleton, which was my first real in-depth exposure, at least, to the whole subject of landmarkism. And as I began plodding around in the original sourcing, I discovered that the landmarkers in general, but more specifically Pendleton himself, had in many ways been maligned historically and misrepresented, because I saw something very different in the life and the original writings of Pendleton than what the secondary sources were actually saying about him. So this became kind of the focus of that particular chapter, to try to supplement, at least, if not hopefully correct, some of our historical thinking about the landmarkers in general, but specifically James Madison Pendleton. Well, in my research along the lines of landmarkism, I came across, of course, the topic of Crawfordism, or the gospel mission movement. I kind of let that float around in the back of my mind for several years, and then began to try to assess whether or not Crawford might be guilty, or that historians might be guilty of the same thing in relation to T.P. Crawford. Is it possible that they could have overstated or maligned him historically, but the original documentation would not necessarily support that? Well, I began to research that and gather data and information along that line, and I felt like there needed to be something significantly done to correct what is generally assumed regarding T.P. Crawford and others, and then I stumbled across it. I didn't need to do it, because there's an excellent, and you'll hear me refer to it here in a moment, an excellent dissertation that was done at Southern Seminary by Adrian Lamkin, which pretty much corrects that historic fallacy for us. Basically, that landmarkism was not landmarkism in essence grabbed hold of the gospel mission movement and used it for its own purposes, and not the reverse. That indeed it was not a natural extension of the landmark controversy here in North America. Well, so as a result, I thought, well, it's been done. Nothing more needs to be said. Maybe I could squeeze an article out of it corroborating further what Lamkin has said and demonstrated. And then I began to be introduced more significantly to the writings of David Bosch, who was the late scholar in charge of the missions department, missiology department at the University of South Africa. And in Bosch's writings, he sets out for us a paradigm theory for the interpretation, if you will, of the historic development of the way in which we do missions historically, going all the way back to the biblical period. And I became intrigued with the intertwine of these two sets of topics. And the more I began to look at the gospel missioners and what they were doing, the more I began to ask myself this question: is it possible that these people were actually advocating principles or values in the way we would engage the mission process that foreshadowed the more recent developments in evangelical life? And actually, part of the reason why they were out of step with their time was because they were thinking way ahead of their peers. And indeed, I think the evidence portrays that for us. Now, to compound this with significance, we're asking ourselves missiologically the very same questions 100 years later that they were asking and trying to advocate answers for 100 years ago. And right in the midst of doing the research for all of this, oddly enough, we saw the Foreign Mission Board completely restructure itself or reconfigure itself just within the last year and a half. It's phenomenal to me to see us actually treading through similar paths where we've been before. And that then leads to the heart of the question: are we going to really be poised for the new century and the challenges of the new millennium in addressing the values and the questions that have been echoing to us ever since the gospel missioners were on the scene in 1892 and following? Or are we indeed actually repeating the same mistakes that we did 100 years ago and freezing out those who actually have the most innovative and provocative things to say to us? With that as a background, then, let me read for you a synopsis of the research that has engaged my attention over the last several years. And you see the title there in the bulletin. It's Gospel Missionism, 1892 to 1910, and the Southern Baptist Convention. It is subtitled Prelude to a Postmodern Missiology. I would hasten to say that my research would also lend itself to adding one more word there: prelude to an evangelical postmodern missiology. I think there is room within Bosch's paradigm to include that word as well. Well, anyway, here's the introduction. At the stroke of midnight, July the 1st, 1997, the world changed. Hong Kong, long since satisfied with its intimate status in the United Kingdom, was ceded back over to the control of the People's Republic of China at the end of a 99-year treaty. Pundits predict both doom and spectacular success, depending upon one's premise. Will Hong Kong change China? or will China dismantle the uniquely profitable port city with its paradoxical blend of free market economics and harsh totalitarian politics? Only time will tell us. I'll pause here a moment and relate a personal story. I was stunned by words very similar to these coming out of the mouth of Dr. Kung, who is the principal, the president of the Hong Kong Baptist Seminary. When Dean Bush and Sean Madden and I were there doing setup for our students in the church planting program in November of 1995, we had an interview with Dr. Kung. And as we met him, I thought, here we are 18 months away from this port city becoming Chinese territory again. And I was expecting these Christian entities to be dismantling their work and moving out, and certainly several were. But I was thrilled when we met Dr. Kung, and I asked him, I said, what do you envision will happen to this seminary when it becomes part of China again? And he got this real excited look on his face. He says, we are preparing hundreds of Chinese students here now with one purpose. I said, what's that? To change China. He said, when that wall comes down and we're able to do it, we're going to flow our students backwards into every main province in mainland China. Pray for them, because they've got an uphill struggle. The Chinese are not going to roll over and do such things lightly. Nevertheless, the world changed July the 1st, 1997, simply for that fact. But it changed in another way. At the same stroke of the clock, facing the challenges of a new century called for radical reconstruction within the Southern Baptist Convention's foreign mission enterprises, Cooperative Services International, or it's also known as CSI, an innovative division of the board, ceased to exist after barely 10 years of operation. Its dissolution was heralded as an acknowledgement of its own success. The board's administration intended to blend CSI's vitalities into the entire corpus of the aging parent organization. Yet, as with Hong Kong, time alone will tell if CSI's influences will indeed change the board, or whether by dismantling CSI we will actually see its vitalities suppressed and the momentum for change so desperately needed to face the demands of a new, brave world squelched. Yet Southern Baptists have been this way before, and perhaps history can be our tutor in these modern circumstances. On the heels of the tumultuous landmark controversy in the last century, a group of Southern Baptist North China missionaries broke away from the board over ideological issues not unlike the values embodied in the CSI system. The Gospel Mission Movement, or Gospel Missionism as it was often called, existed as a historical entity from 1892 to 1910. Now, there was a follow-through. T.L. Blaylock continued as an independent missionary and changed the name of it to Direct Missions and Independent Direct Baptist Missions later, but for the formality of the Gospel Mission Movement itself, before it was transformed by one individual, it actually collapsed by 1910. Its ideals and values were most fully developed and lived out through the lives of Tarleton Perry Crawford, who lived from 1821 to 1902, and Martha Foster Crawford from 1830 to 1909. If you're ever interested in tracking some of this yourself, Mrs. Crawford wrote 7 volumes of a diary over 50 years of living in China. And those 7 volumes are on file in the archive section at Duke University, also available on microfilm. Fascinating reading. Also, the life of David Wells Herring from 1858, he lived till 1940. Near the end of his life, Crawford attempted to set forth the driving ideals that guided him through his missionary career, emphasizing the need for an autonomous direction to the work of the missionaries and the churches that they represented. At the time Crawford defended his missiological opinions, few could predict that some of his concepts would eventually capture the imagination of future Southern Baptist mission leaders and actually be issued forth as policy revisions within the board's standard operating procedures that reflected his influence, albeit perhaps unknown to them. Crawford's ideas did nevertheless stimulate one of the most provocative controversies in Southern Baptist mission circles. To some of his contemporaries, his missiological convictions threatened the established operation of the Foreign Mission Board. Today, leaders of the board are again faced with the challenge of innovation through the varied initiatives and successes of CSI. This paper aims at assessing the degree to which the gospel mission movement reflected an incipient form of an evangelical postmodern paradigm and suggests insights for contemporary decision makers as the board faces a new century of challenges. Paradigm theory. We need to back up and first ask ourselves, what is this all about? And it was introduced to the mission world, at least, first through the prolific writings of David Bosch. He was of the University of South Africa, and what he did was he used Thomas Kuhn's paradigm theories that were developed for interpreting changes in scientific methods and understandings in a different discipline, and he erected structures for interpreting the ebb and flow of missiological trends throughout the eras of the Christian work. And probably the work that you would need to refer to there is his magnum opus, published just a few years before his untimely death in a car accident, and it's simply entitled Transforming Mission, subtitled Paradigm Shifts in the Theology of Mission. In so doing, Bosch provided a set of models that help missiologists look back in order to begin the process of sorting out the future. As the world is undergoing radical changes in geopolitical arenas, similarly, modern mission trends are showing signs of equally drastic change. At the end of this century, one is increasingly aware that there is a distinct difference in the way Christian missions ought to perceive the mandate that it has, design strategies for its engagement, and apply the same as the church enters the next century. Yet the nature of these changes is elusive unless we back up and view current circumstances from the vantage point of the larger context in long-term mission developments. Methods used by missionaries throughout most of the last century tended to reflect more of what Bosch terms the, quote, Constantinian era, unquote, or an Enlightenment era understanding of truth that is seen in the modern shifting scene. A shift to a position that affirms other cultures and is less paternalistic has not come about suddenly. It developed bit by bit, person by person, idea by idea, until a new set of perceptions and values changed the way things are generally done. Individual denominations experiencing change in varying degrees depending on the given set of founding convictions, outside influences, and willingness to accept or to adapt to innovations all became factors in the process. The Foreign Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention, and I'm using the term Foreign Mission Board here, let me just put a proviso in here, because most of the data that I'm looking at from the 1890s and on, well, actually long before that, all refer to it as the Foreign Mission Board. That's because we've only made a name change since last June. And so as a result, just so we don't get confused and I don't get confused in the writing of these things, I've stuck with the term Foreign Mission Board just for consistency's sake. So I am aware that the board has changed its name, but I explained to you why I'm continuing to use the old term. The Foreign Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention has usually, historically, been very slow to accept change. One case in point is the gospel mission movement itself. It developed due to the collective field experiences of the Crawfords, who were then veteran missionaries in 1892, and a host of younger, new missionaries in the North China Mission. Was this simply a renegade movement that reflected insubordinate attitudes because of anti-board sentiments? Or is there evidence that the gospel mission field personnel actually reflected values, albeit in an incipient and perhaps unconscious form, like those of an emerging shift in modern mission methods that was more in keeping with what Bosch would later call postmodern missiology? Baptist historians have tended to see the gospel mission movement through the lens of another movement that developed earlier, namely the landmark movement. In order to determine the degree to which their conclusion is warranted, one must set the gospel mission movement into the broader context of the 19th century China and the Protestant mission milieu of that time. Determination of the gospel missioners' core values is essential to the aims of this paper. Since the elemental ideas surfaced in and through the field ministries of Crawford, Herring, and the lives of others, they are integral to this study. They are reviewed in order to detect the field forces that influenced and shaped their missiological understandings and practices. Finally, there is a comparison of the core values of the gospel missioners with those identified by Bosch as indicative of the Enlightenment era and the emerging postmodern paradigm. Incipient forms of postmodern ideals expressed by the gospel missioners will not necessarily bear the model's more mature traits, but they should show, if the hypothesis is true, some marks of these later developments. Now we move to the contemporary milieu of the gospel mission movement, and we start with a basic introductory grafting of the understanding of Southern Baptists and their work in China. On November 17, 1851, the Crawfords set sail for China and embarked on more than a sea voyage. They started to fulfill what they perceived to be God's calling on their lives. The Crawfords joined the work in the Central China Mission, which was then under the leadership of Matthew T. Yates, who is a graduate of this school. Not this school as Southeastern, but this campus as Wake Forest College. And there's a plaque commemorating Matthew T. Yates, up in the World Mission Prayer Room. Very historically significant in terms of the work that was done in China. And they came there and arrived to start their work under Matthew T. Yates on March the 30th, 1852. Tarleton and Mary lived out their ministries in three cities spanning three periods. From 1852 to 1863, they worked attached to the Central China Mission under Matthew T. Yates. In 1863, they were chosen to be a part of the group that was going to then relocate to Tung Chau and to help start the North China Mission. There, they worked until 1892 when they moved to Tianfu, closer into the interior of China, in order to establish the base of operations for the gospel mission movement. In 1900, they evacuated China during the Boxer Uprising, and in order to assess the gospel mission's values, we must first determine what validity there may be to the claim that the movement was simply a foreign expression of the landmark controversy here in the United States. And we turn our attention then to that question at this point, the landmark challenge. Crawford was home from China and attended the now infamous 1859 Southern Baptist Convention meeting when J.R. Graves, the architect of the landmark movement, challenged the very existence of the Foreign Mission Board specifically, and by implication, he was actually threatening the whole concept of a convention and its operations in a federalized way. Is this simply a coincidence? Or was Crawford, who was actually sent out as a missionary by the Big Hatchie Association in Tennessee, which was the association where J.R. Graves had his most radical supporters in that very context, somehow connected to and in sympathy with Graves' ideas? Was Crawford a landmarker who was working within to subvert the board's operations? This issue is crucial to our understanding of the gospel mission movement. In this writer's opinion, the evidence supports the idea that landmarkism near the end of the 19th century needed a fresh infusion of controversy in order to sustain its interests. When Crawford and the other gospel missioners issued a clarion call from China that was in sympathy with certain elements of landmark ideology, the landmarkist leaders seized upon the gospel mission movement for their own ends and not the reverse. This is very strongly documented in the dissertation that I mentioned to you a moment ago by Adrian Lampkin. Dr. Estep, in his recent book, Whole Gospel, Whole World, on the history of the Foreign Mission Board, in a footnote, pretty much applauds Adrian Lampkin's work, and coming from a veteran church historian, pretty much helps to correct the misperceptions that have ensued down through history. So the question then is this: since this premise is justifiable, one may then investigate the gospel mission phenomenon based on its own merits. You see, we've never really taken the time to hear what they were saying about field-driven needs and missionary practices because we easily just smeared them with landmark labeling and never listened to what else they had to say. So if we now, thanks to Dr. Lampkin, can remove that stigma and set it aside to some degree, We then have to look for what is it that caused these missionaries to break from the board while they were on the field in China, not knowing where their next dollar would come from. Something had to drive them, some sort of passion, and that raises the question, what was it? Freed from the hindrance of linking the gospel missioners exclusively to landmark ecclesiology, a question then arises about what other factors, China-based factors, motivated Crawford and others to form their own new organization in 1892. Crawford himself and landmarkism, though, must be addressed. Field circumstances, issues, and influences help explain the driving forces behind the gospel mission's values. Ecclesiological concerns developed chronologically as only secondary issues. It was only after Crawford, Herring, and others sensed that they were being ignored, or as Crawford said, frozen out, ignored by the board's leadership, and they were then hindered from communicating their ideas in any way with the churches that actually were supporting them and sending them out, it's only then that they broke away from the board's control. When the break did come, they had no alternative but to appeal directly to the constituent churches that were willing to listen to their ideas. Ecclesiology at that point became important, and only at that point. The field-based roots of the movement were noted by some of the gospel missionaries' peers as well. In 1907, the China Protestant missionaries, all of the Protestant missionaries, gathered together to commemorate their first whole century of work, commemorating the work of Robert Morrison and others who pioneered the work, the Protestant work in China in the first place, a century before. The committee in charge of organizing that meeting commissioned a historical volume documenting this century's worth of progress. This work listed the gospel mission movement as, quote, the gospel Baptist mission Shantung, unquote. The book is essentially a summary of each mission's development. Regarding the origin of the mission as a breakaway from the Southern Baptist Board, it simply states this, quote, there were two main causes for the separation. The one on the field, which came first in point of time, was a desire on the part of the missionaries to cultivate a healthy self-support among the native Christians by keeping out of view as much as possible foreign monies. The other matter aimed at was to bring into closer relationship the missionary on the field and his constituency at home. Now, Kenneth Scott Latourette, writing at a later period, of course, in his history of mission work in China, affirms this in a different way, and he says, quote, on the one hand, more quickly, that the gospel mission movement was formed, on the one hand, more quickly to promote the self-support and independence of Chinese churches, and on the other hand, to bring the individual missionary into a closer contact with local congregations in America. Many historians continue, however, to associate the gospel missionism or gospel mission movement directly with the landmark movement, and to conclude that it was simply an outgrowth of the latter. In a recent biographical account of B.H. Carroll, one observer repeats this suspect conclusion by stating that, quote, Carroll staunchly opposed landmarkers like Crawford and Hayden because they threatened Baptist solidarity and the viability of organized missions. That was by an individual who also published in the very same volume that I did on James Madison Pendleton in Baptist Theologians. It was the chapter on B.H. Carroll. The latter was a landmarker by choice, namely Hayden, but the former does not warrant the label in quite the same way. W.W. Barnes, a noted Southern Baptist historian of an earlier generation, published what has become, or what had it in a different generation, had become a standard text in 1954. In it, he surveyed the gospel mission movement in relation to landmarkism and focused on the latter phases while ignoring the field issues. Quote, this is from Barnes, the gospel missioners made the same attack on the convention and its boards that the anti-missioners and J.R. Graves, as well as Alexander Campbell, had previously made. They proposed the same methods in the homeland and on the foreign field. But I want to draw your attention to this. Barnes's observations were based on evidence relating to the issues during and after the time that the landmark movement had seized the gospel mission movement for its purposes. He does not deal with the primary sources pertaining to Crawford, Herring, and others in order to determine what they say their reasons were for breaking with the board. Other scholars have delved into the subject and have also drawn inaccurate conclusions regarding the degree to which Crawford could have been in contact with or influenced by Graves and Pendleton and others. Irwin T. Hyatt, who has published a book entitled Our Ordered Lives, confess, subtitled Three 19th Century American Missionaries in East Shantung, one of whom that he studies is Martha Foster Crawford. And he has nothing but disregard and ill feelings for T.P. Crawford, and it definitely comes through. What I'm about to read is a quote from Hyatt in which he makes certain logical assumptions, but without checking the original sources. Here's a quote, a note from Hyatt at Harvard. A note on the Big Hatchie Association is in order here, as Crawford's connection with it is tied to his subsequent gospel mission theology. The landmarkers dedicated to the primacy of the local church over the Southern Baptist Convention and its denominational boards, organized at the Big Hatchie annual meeting of 1851. The next year, Crawford was selected as the association's own missionary. James Madison Pendleton, leader or prophet of that group, was Union University's leading professor and very likely Crawford's sponsor before the Big Hatchie membership. What you're going to see here in just a moment is when Hyatt leaves himself a little gap here when he says, and very likely. He draws conclusions, however, without going back and checking out whether he could say for sure instead of very likely. In reflecting on Crawford's Big Hatchie, then the quote is finished and I'm resuming here. In reflecting on Crawford's Big Hatchie connection, Hyatt makes two mistaken assumptions. First, he sequences the events incorrectly. The Big Hatchie Association only gradually came to accept Graves' conclusions regarding the boards, and that was well after Crawford had departed for China in 1852. Otherwise, it seems illogical for Crawford to write to the recording secretary of the Foreign Mission Board with apparent consternation and surprise over Graves' activities in his home association, expressing full support for the board, as well as criticizing Graves' influence there nearly 13 years after the crucial Showdown Convention in 1859. He's writing in 1871, and Crawford says, quote, I have seen for years that the Big Hatchie Association could not do anything toward my support because of the anti-foreign mission influence existing there. They cannot do anything at their big meeting for the ubiquitous bookstore. This was his way of referring to Graves' Tennessee Baptist newspaper. Is always present at these meetings. He says to the recording secretary, he says, don't give up on the Western churches, but do all that you can to keep them cooperating with the Foreign Mission Board. Crawford wrote in the same letter that Graves was, quote, the author of all the opposition to the foreign missions, and all other enterprises which he thinks interfere with him, and there was an emphasis there by Crawford, and his publishing house, unquote. Hyatt implies that forming the association in 1851 and sending Crawford in 1852 are so closely linked that it necessarily means that Crawford was anti-board and Graves-like and a Graves-like partisan in the landmark movement. Additionally, Hyatt presumes that because Pendleton taught at Union University that he was, quote, very likely Crawford's sponsor before the Big Hatchie Association, unquote. Chronologically, however, this does not fit the facts. Pendleton did not even move to Tennessee until 1857, and only then did he assume the post at Union University. So it is impossible for him to have been one of Crawford's professors or even to have sponsored him before the association. Pendleton wrote, quote, on the first Sunday in January 1857, I left Bowling Green, Kentucky, and removed myself to Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Nothing had been more unexpected by me. The explanation of this matter is simply this. The trustees of Union University decided to establish a theological department in the institution, and to my amazement, they appointed me as professor. Now, that happened in 1857, unquote. Crawford, however, entered Union University in 1848 and graduated and married Martha in 1851 and sailed for China in November of 1851. By the time Pendleton actually assumed his duties at Union University, Crawford had already been in China for over 5 years. Whatever his faults, Crawford was not a landmarker when he set sail for China in 1851. It was 40 years after he first arrived in China that Crawford broke away from the board in 1892 and began espousing ideas regarding the authority of boards in relation to local churches with which many landmarkers could agree. And that opinion materialized only under duress when the board had silenced him. Two additional items need elaboration here. A cardinal principle to landmarkers was that only local New Testament church congregations were legitimately capable of engaging the gospel ministry functions prescribed for the church. Since, as Graves and others espouse, Baptist churches practiced the ordinances according to the New Testament principles, they alone could rightly be acclaimed as real biblical churches. Because local churches bestow the authority for the gospel ministry upon God-called individuals, only Baptist ministers could be sanctioned to do these things. As late as 1878, Crawford saw no need to apply this principle. When he left the field to come home on furlough, he left, quote, a Reverend Matier of the Presbyterian Mission, unquote, to serve as interim pastor and to take supervision over his Baptist church in Tung Chau, China. Next, it is not completely accurate to say that Crawford, even in his most bellicose moments, and I will stop here a moment and agree with some, that he did have a bit of a temper. It does seem to be that he could be bellicose on occasion. That it's not fair to say that even in his most bellicose moments, however, that he rejected the notion of boards and conventions in toto. In Crawford's most provocative work, Churches to the Front, which actually is the book that got him fired, or got his wife removed from the, or got his name removed from the list of missionaries. In Crawford's most provocative work, he clarified his position as follows. Now listen to this. This is Crawford. Again, I am not opposed to the existence of conventions, societies, boards, or committees of the proper kind and in the proper place or for the proper purpose. But I am deeply opposed to all those which intrude themselves and their enterprises upon the churches, to all those which take any part of their work, their workers, or their funds away from their control. While opposing all intruding boards, I could readily sanction general and state conventions for mutual acquaintance, for interchange of views on matters of common concern, for gathering information regarding the condition of the work in the various churches, for stimulating their religious zeal and Christian fellowship, and for keeping the unity of the faith in the bonds of gospel love, purity, and peace. But these conventions should not collect funds, employ no men, hold no property, and exercise no authority or government over the work of the churches. And he closes that pamphlet with this statement, Churches to the Front. Considering the sequence of events which led Crawford to appeal directly to the churches, indeed, he did not oppose all boards. Rather, he tried to express his ideas through the board. He came to oppose boards that, in his opinion, were structured in such a way as to bypass the will of the churches that they were established to represent. Crawford concluded that the Southern Baptist Convention's Foreign Mission Board was guilty of such an abuse of authority. The broader evangelical community of Protestant missionaries expressed ideas which were similar to those advocated by Crawford. Self-support or indigeneity issues were continually present at all the various meetings that the missionaries had. One example is expressed by Crawford contemporary when commenting on the need for native churches to assume their biblical role and become more in control of their own affairs, including their financial support, when he wrote, quote, the native church, or even when awakened to a sense of their importance, is often disposed to agree against the practical adoption of the self-support principles on the grounds of poverty or some other pressing and merely local reason. It seems so much easier and safer to depend on the wealth of foreign churches than it is to depend on God himself, unquote. That's an unsigned article that is was a contemporary of Crawford in a different denomination writing along the same themes. It is safe to say that some of Crawford's ideas were compatible with landmarkism, but to conclude that he was an ardent advocate of the J.R. Graves type landmarkism goes beyond the evidence. Landmarkers, however, took advantage of the overlap with some of Tarleton's ideas and used them for their own ends. But the origin of Crawford's principles is simply found in his field experiences. Along with those of Herring, one can see a Baptist version of missiological values that were emerging in other Protestant missions, primarily the so-called faith mission movement. It's safe to say that at least through the influence of Herring, that what they were attempting to do partially was to Southern baptize the dynamism and the vitality that they saw in the China Inland Mission that was being so successful under the leadership of J. Hudson Taylor. Tarleton Perry and Martha Foster Crawford in China. This is a quote, again an unsigned article in the Foreign Mission Journal that was published in September 1893, right at the heyday and the height and the zenith of the controversy that ensued after all these missionaries had resigned. This is what appeared in the Foreign Mission Journal in an attempt to compare what Crawford and them were wanting done in response to them breaking away. He says, "There is unquestionably more of romance, more of what is commonly called heroism in the new plan than in the old." I want you to see the new and the old pitted against each other. "But we believe that as faith without works is dead, so a bare trust in God, without the use of means suggested by sound common sense, is fanaticism." I want you to notice the 19th century arrogance of thinking that we are the captains of our own fate, where relying on God becomes secondary to sound judgment. I don't mean to imply that we ought to be stupid in what we do and just trust God, but I don't think that we necessarily have to pit the two against each other. That's what it sounds like in this article. This unsigned article in the official publishing organ of the Foreign Mission Board illustrates the tension that arose over the missiological methodologies advocated by the gospel missioners. The dialogue had become a public debate over differing mission methods to the extent that one model was called old and the other one new. A paradigm war ensued. What were the issues? Was the gospel mission movement consisting of maverick innovators or renegade revolutionaries? In order to assess this situation, the core values of the mission movement need clear exposition. Here are the core values. Just before he died in 1902, Tarleton finished a biographical account of how he developed his missiological ideology. He wove his life and field experiences around the development of very specific missionary convictions. In that account, he summarized his understanding of gospel mission values as follows. "The gospel mission movement is sustained and propelled by the cooperation of three leading convictions, which may be briefly expressed as follows. First, the gospel of Christ as the power of God unto salvation in every mission field, unaccompanied by any kind of pecuniary inducement to the peoples, or in other words, through native self-support everywhere. Two, that the churches of Christ should, as organized bodies, singly or in cooperating groups, do their own mission work without the intervention of any kind of outside convention, association, or board." And given his earlier statements, we mean a board that would interfere and would basically coerce the churches rather than being the servant to the churches. Third, self-denying labors for Christ's sake, both by the churches at home and by the missionaries abroad. I'm going to skip some of this. Crawford was negatively impacted by a man named Carl Gutzlaff, because at the time he arrived in Hong Kong, when he first got there in 1852, Gutzlaff's experiment was in full vogue, and what had happened is he was restricted to the port city of Hong Kong, and he hired nationals, gave them literature, and sent them into the provinces in China. What he did not know was that many of the nationals were actually taking his literature and taking the salary he had given them, and they were going back to the printers and giving the literature to the printers, who would then sell it to Gutzlaff again, and they would then get paid again to go back out. And it became just a real farce, and this negatively impacted Crawford, although he does say that it was basically good methodology, but the problem was the individuals involved.